and welcome to Pan Society Radio, your home for modern animism. I'm your host and the founder of Pan Society, Laura Giles. You know, we don't talk about death enough. It's scary for a lot of people. They don't want to think about other people's death, and especially not their own. They certainly don't want to plan for it. And today, I'm talking with Lucinda Herring, author of Reimagining Death, Stories and Practical Wisdom for Home Funerals and Green Burials. For now, let's create sacred space to give us a spiritual and safe container from which to operate. I call on the element of earth and thank you for the firm foundation upon which we live and the abundant food that you give us every day. I ask that we find our earth energy inside to help create for ourselves a sense of safety, stability, and security so that we can make our dreams a reality. I call on the element of air and thank you for carrying our prayers to our ancestors and helping spirits and bringing us their messages in the form of intuition and dreams. I ask that you help us find the air within to tap into that creative energy that all children have and we can lose as adults so that we're always a source of inspiration to ourselves and others. I call on the element of fire to help stir our passions in positive connecting ways and give us the will to see our ideas through. I call on the element of water to help keep us flowing in the rhythm of life. I give thanks to the water for the life-giving properties that it brings to all creatures. I call to our loving, shining ancestors and angels who are always looking out for us. I ask that you be here with us today to guide our footsteps. I ask that you speak to us in words that we understand so that we never miss your messages. I send you love and gratitude for all that you do every day, whether we are aware of it or not. I know a lot of people don't like to talk about death, but me being the Scorpio rising, this is one of my favorite topics. So let's get to our guest.
Welcome, Lucinda. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laura. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
So let's start with a little bit about you. Can you tell us what you do? Like, what's your title?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's actually an interesting question. I do a lot of things, but right now I'm working in the field of death and dying as a certified home funeral guide and green burial guide and consultant, and actually a licensed funeral director in the state of Washington. I would call myself an alternative green licensed funeral director because I work in that movement rather than the conventional funeral industry. I'm also an interfaith minister and have worked with families and children and communities for many years, helping people recover connection and meaning in daily life, and also connection with the earth and the seasons and the elements, and that's really my heart work. And actually my work in death and dying and in the green funeral movement comes directly out of a deep passion for all of us to build community again with each other and with the earth. Yeah.
I love that. That is so interesting. So how did you embark upon that path? What was your inspiration?
Which path? The death?
All
line?
Of those. But particularly the ones with the burial.
Interestingly, I guess I would call myself a threshold person. You know, as a minister, people tend to come to me at times of transition and change in life. So I've done a lot of weddings, I've done a lot of ritual for birth and blessing ways and divorce, and in the past that's what people have come to me for, and so it was, you know, only a matter of time before people would also come to me at death when someone they love had died, or if they were dying themselves. I'm certainly been asked at times to be a companion at that threshold. So when my friend died, actually a friend here in the community, Judy, she was dying of breast cancer in 1997. She asked all of her women friends to care for her, and she said she really didn't want to go to a funeral home if if at all possible, and could we care for her after death instead and make sure that she was cremated? And we didn't know at the time if we could do that. Obviously, that's the way we used to care for the dead. But, you know, in this day and time, it's not accepted or a normalized kind of thing to care for our own dead after death. But we researched it and realized it was entirely legal in our state, and that we certainly could do it, and that we could keep her for up to 3 days legally. So we just took it upon ourselves to care for Judy. And that experience was so transformative that we realized we didn't really want to do it any other way, if possible. We realized that, you know, certain deaths, we certainly, you have to engage with the funeral industry and with the law enforcement. I mean, that's if there's an accident on the highway, a death happens that way, or any unexpected death where you don't know the cause of death, all of those things are more problematical, although not impossible for families to care for their own dead. But we just started learning what we could and couldn't do, and we realized that one of us should go and get certified. And interestingly enough, there were lots of women all over at least the West Coast, actually the whole country, I would say, in the late 90s who were coming to these same inquiries. It was like a collective wave, you know, in our collective unconsciousness, that we really can care for our own dead, and it's our innate sacred right to do so. And so we were part of a much larger collective movement, although we didn't know that. But I did find someone in California, Jerry Grace Lyons, who still owns Final Passages. She teaches home funeral guides, and I trained with her, and I also decided that I should become a licensed funeral director to be able to interface with the funeral industry creditably and not be, you know, on the fringes doing this kind of work, but really bring it right into the mainstream way of caring for our dead, because it felt really important to do so. And then I realized in all of that journey that the way we are doing death in our society today is actually very toxic and harmful for the earth and for the environment. And, you know, because we have such a denial of death and fear of death, we are oblivious in a way to the environmental costs of the funeral industry practices that we have today. So I became much more interested in the green aspect, you know, the more natural after-death care. And that's one reason I've written my book, Reimagining Death, because I wanted more people to know, you know, the consequences of how we're doing death, and also know that there are different ways that we can choose to make our end-of-life plans and choose different dispositions that are more ecologically sustainable and care for the earth.
So what would you say are the big differences between a conventional funeral and a green funeral?
Well, green means natural. You know, that's become it's kind of a term that's used, green now. It means natural. So I would say that a lot of our conventional funeral practices are not natural, including really the practice of automatically calling a funeral director to come and get someone whom we love, you know, within an hour after they die. It's quite jarring for a lot of people, especially if they've cared for someone, you know, as an ill person for many weeks and months, and then suddenly you give over that care to a stranger in the funeral industry, and they come and pick the body up and take it away. And if that person is going to be cremated, then you never see that person again. And as a funeral director myself, in the years that I've worked in a funeral home, I've really experienced the shock and the unresolved grief in a lot of families, right, who just have their loved one taken away too soon. So I would say that that is not natural, really. It's what mm-hmm. we've come to do, we're accustomed to do, we don't even question it, but it actually isn't natural. What's natural is to need, is to want time and spaciousness around the event of death, and it's instinctive to want that. It may be that our natural instincts are hidden, though, because, you know, we have bought into this more conventional way of doing it. And we have a lot of fear, too. I mean, people do fear being around bodies, dead bodies, and that's mm-hmm. because we've had no experience with them or very little experience mm-hmm. with them, right? But all of that, to me, is conventional practice rather than our innate understanding of what we need to do when someone we love dies. And mm-hmm. I would go further and say what we need when we die, when our consciousness leaves our bodies. I think we need a lot more time separation to happen than our mm-hmm. Western medical model allows or even admits is possible. So
is it okay if I ask you some logistical questions?
Sure.
Okay. I don't want to be indelicate, but I'm sure that if we have listeners that have never heard of this, or they're just like, you know, their mind's blown just hearing this because this is not how we do it now, they're right. going to have these questions.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Does the body smell?
Hardly ever, in my experience. There's a very specific protocol that one should follow if you're going to keep someone at home after death. Mm-hmm. It's actually the law in Washington State, and it's different in every state, so it's important to know that. The law in Washington State says that you should refrigerate a body within 24 hours of a death, mm-hmm. and yet that refrigeration term is loose enough that you can use dry ice to keep the body cold, or, you know, keep the windows open. There are many ways you can do that to keep a body cold. So if you do that protocol, the body does not smell, especially if you use dry ice or what's called Techne ice. That's a newer development now. It freezes mm-hmm. the organs in the core of the body and basically stops the decomposition for a time. Okay. Or slows it down. So in my experience, there's not been smell at any of these vigils. And when I say vigil, I mean keeping someone, you know, for a few hours after death, for 24 mm-hmm. hours, for 2 days, or up to 3 days.
Okay.
Yes.
And where would
that
somebody
get that?
But that's a
worry. Sorry, it's a worry that a lot of people have. So I'm glad we're talking about it. Yeah.
Yeah, so I, you know, I'm a little embarrassed to ask the question, but I'm sure other people have thought of that.
No,
where
I'm
would
glad
you get
you
that much
it.
Dry ice? I'm
sorry. You get it. Different places have it. Different grocery stores have it in their fish department. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and a lot of people use dry ice for parties and things, and for theater props. And so it's not as hard to find as one would think, although there are areas of the country I've heard where it is more difficult, and in those cases I would recommend looking online and finding things like Techne ice or freezer bricks and those kind of things, and then just having mm-hmm. those you know, on hand if you need it. I mean, these questions all bring up the very important point that if you're going to do this kind of care yourself, if you're caring for your own dead, you need to think about it beforehand, you need to prepare, mm-hmm. and you need to know what's legal in your state, what's possible. It would be very good to talk to, you know, the hospice nurses if the person who's dying is in hospice, to let them know that you want to do it. It's very important to be proactive and be prepared. And in mm-hmm. my book, I write about that, how important it is to make what I'm calling now advanced after death care directives, which is a next mm-hmm. step on from an advanced directive, a health directive, which, you know, mm-hmm. covers time before you die. And this directive that I'm speaking of covers all your plans for what you'd like after you die.
Okay.
With the idea that it's, you know, it's not something that's done in the conventional funeral industry, going back to that question, so much, mm-hmm. although it's becoming more and more accepted and popular throughout the country. But it's still pioneering. And so mm-hmm. It's very important to have these questions and answer them and know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. So what about washing the body? What is that necessary?
It's not necessary. Well, I would say it's necessary if at the time of death the body purges and, you know, the normal bodily functions are there at the time of death. It would be good to wash the body and mm-hmm. just it, you know, that's another instinctive thing that you want to do, that to have that person be clean and cared for in a sacred way.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people do it, and they do it instinctively again. Hospice mm-hmm. often helps families do that also. There are some spiritual faiths, and the Buddhist faith, there's one lineage, Vajrayana lineage, where it's important to not touch the body right after death in their belief system,
mm-hmm.
and because they feel like it might interfere with the consciousness leaving the body in the best way.
Mm.
And so in that lineage, of which I've been a part for a long time, we don't wash the body for at least 24 hours, and then mm-hmm. we do what we can if the person has requested it or the family requests it. We do wash the body, but after a time where we feel like the person has had its own space without being mm-hmm. Interfered with. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But washing
really
the body.
Things.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well,
really interesting things to think about, because if it's not imminent, you just might not even think about it until it's upon you, and then it could just be too late, you know, because things got to get moving.
That's right. Yeah. That's, again, why it's important to say, I actually really want someone to care for me after death. Can you do
mm-hmm.
that? You know, and have the
mm-hmm.
family say yes instead of no, I don't want to, which some families
right.
do. And
mm-hmm.
And have things ready. You know, have things ready. To wash a body, it's important to have things ready, like a beautiful bowl. You can have sacred water in it with essential oils and towels and maybe a plastic covering, you know, under the place where the body's lying. It's a whole, again, a whole art and skill, and that's why you train for it. I trained to understand these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of information now out there online about how to do that, especially with the National Home Funeral Alliance. They have a website. That's an organization that I helped form in the early 2000s to, again, make this whole reclaiming of caring for our own dead accepted and, you know, part of life again, bringing it back into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say to anyone listening to us, you know, to go to that website. It's homefuneralalliance.org, and
mm-hmm.
there's just all kinds of information there. To
okay.
answer these kind of questions, yeah.
So assuming it's a burial and not a cremation, then how do you prepare the body to go into the ground?
The same way. Actually, one part I didn't finish the question when you asked what's the difference between conventional, you know, industry practices and more natural ones, green ones.
Mm-hmm.
That's particularly clear the difference in the matter of burial, because conventional burial often requires that the body be embalmed, and the body, especially if it's going to be viewed in a funeral home, they require embalming, or they they say it's their policy. Often people think it's the law that you need to be embalmed, but it's never the law. It's a policy of that funeral home. Hmm. And families have, again, the legal right to say, we don't want my family member to be embalmed. And a lot of reason that people are asking that now is because embalming is incredibly toxic and very invasive to the body. So if you have any spiritual awareness of, you know, that consciousness trying to leave the body in an uninterrupted way, then just the very procedure of embalming goes against all of those, that kind of sensibility. Mm-hmm. But it's also very toxic. And so in a conventional burial, a body's usually embalmed. They're usually in a casket, which is metal and steel gasketed made from endangered species of wood. They're then in a concrete vault. So a lot of cemeteries now require, as policy, again, not law, but as policy, they require that the casket go into a cement vault. So the vault is there in the ground, then the casket goes in, then it's sealed with a lid, and then the earth is put on top of it. So conventional funeral home practices mean that the cemeteries that they've bought and have these policies, which are required in order to be buried there, those cemeteries essentially, this is a harsh thing to say, but it's true, are toxic landfills.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we just don't think about this very much.
Mm-hmm.
We don't question. And we're in shock and grief, usually, right, when we go to a funeral home and ask to be make these arrangements. We're in grief, and we don't question these policies that are very destructive to the environment. And not that healing or supportive of the families, in my experience. Because, again, we give everything away to the funeral directors and the strangers and ask them to do everything for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in natural burial, let's go back to in natural burial, you would not be embalmed. The body cannot be embalmed if you're buried in a green cemetery, and we can talk about what that means in a minute. You're not embalmed. You need to be buried in a biodegradable container of some kind. It could be cardboard. It could be hardwood, you know, pine, simple pine coffin. Some cemeteries require that you don't even have metal, so you don't have metal screws or nails in the coffin, although some cemeteries are not that specific about that.
Mm.
The body itself can just be in a shroud, a biodegradable shroud, and there are people all over the country now making beautiful shrouds that people can be buried in. And that's literally the body is just in a shroud and placed in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
There's no concrete vault, so basically the grave is just dug and the body is placed in the grave. And you can make it quite beautiful by lining the grave with moss and ferns and greens and flowers, and then you lower the body down, and then you put compost on top of the body to help the decomposition happen more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can see in all of this, families who choose this are often much more involved. They're much more participatory. They're hands-on, right? They're carrying the body themselves to the grave. They're digging the grave sometimes themselves. Then they're filling the grave in and singing and, you know, saying prayers. And it's just, again, much more involving of the people who love that person who's being buried.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in conventional practices, you know, often, I mean, we've all been to them, and it's not that they're wrong. I want to say that very clearly. It's just it often doesn't allow families to be involved in ways that are cathartic and healing. So you'll go to an open grave. There'll be artificial green turf, which is plastic often, around the edge of the grave. There's a metal lowering device with a crank. The casket is often, like I said, metal, you know, and steel gasketed. The funeral director's in charge. The family sits under a tent in little chairs. And, you know, they have wonderful services. That's always true. But they're not engaged with the actual burying of the person they love. In fact, often a family will leave, right? And then the whole covering up of the grave, or even the lowering of the casket down into the grave, is done when the family's not even there to witness it. So you can just feel the difference, right? You can feel the difference in that. And in my own life and experience with this, Laura, I've just seen how incredibly healing it can be for families to re-engage with these processes, with washing the bodies of their loved ones, with dressing them in the clothes that they knew they loved, and, you know, bringing flowers to surround the body and beautiful candles and people telling stories and crying and having all the emotions that they have, and they can do that because they're at home in a safe place and not in some strange room in a funeral home, right?
It sounds like it's very healing for the family and for the spirit that's crossing on.
That's right. I feel that. I mean, you know, it's hard for me to say that definitively, but I've had experiences of truly feeling the presence of that person, staying around because they're basking in the field of love that's created around that that person. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've had experiences.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I also have had experiences when someone has died suddenly, of that soul being in shock on the other side and needing desperately to have some sort of reference point and feel the love of the people who love that person. And the vigil creates a container where that is possible. I mean, it's not always important, you know, because if someone has died suddenly, they might be in a morgue in a coroner's office, right? Or in a funeral home or in a hospital. So you don't have to physically be present, really, but the container of space and attention around that threshold, that transition, is very helpful for the person leaving, in my experience.
In your book, you talk about the headstone. So what is the purpose of foregoing the headstone?
I mean, I love old cemeteries. So it's not, again, it's not like headstones are wrong in any way. They can be such a beautiful tribute to a person who's died. You know, it's such a wonderful and special experience to go back to a grave where there's a lovely headstone that you've chosen for that person. So, again, I don't want to make any of those practices wrong. But we are overpopulated, you know, in our world. And the idea of buying plots and having deeds and land to put our body in them and have them there forever with a headstone or tombstone, you know, that's quite large and takes up a lot of space. I mean, this whole way that we have done death has had an assumption that we'll always have cemeteries. We'll always have places that can be just set aside for us to have these plots where we put our bodies in there forever. And I think people are trying to reimagine that. That's why I called it reimagining death. Reimagining other ways to care for our dead and dispose of our bodies after death that doesn't take up so much land. Mm-hmm. And again, those cemeteries are very toxic in the way we're doing them today. So, you know, the use of pesticides and herbicides in the lawns of the cemetery.
Yeah.
Just all of that needs to be looked at and reimagined. And so in this newer way of trying to create burials that are more natural, natural burial grounds and conservation burial grounds, say that having headstones, you know, doesn't really preserve the ecosystem and the ecologies of a certain place. And if you're really going to care for the earth in the way that you die, in the way that you're buried, you do need to take into consideration the preservation and conservation of that piece of land where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so headstones, you know, are not, they don't really support that.
Mm-hmm.
So in natural burial grounds, and especially in conservation burial grounds, which are preserving wilderness from future development, essentially, and also preserving ecosystems, then you can have some beautiful stone for a headstone, but it's part of the land itself where you're buried.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can plant a tree that is natural to that ecosystem. And it honors you, and that is, in a sense, your headstone, but it's not a big concrete structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's reimagining it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of what you're saying is that we just go back to the way that things used to be. So how did we get from natural death to funeral parlors and embalming and chemicals and all of that?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. We're going back to the way we used to do it. But we're also going forward because conservation burial ground is, you know, we didn't have that long ago.
True.
We didn't actually set aside whole tracts of land that would be in conservation easements for the future. You know, that's new. It's a wonderful turn of the spiral of the way we used to just bury our dead by digging a hole and putting someone in it and putting, you know, dirt over them and putting a marker there. So, yes, we are going back and we're going forward in good ways. How we got there really started before the Civil War or at the Civil War. I mean, before, families should always care for their dead. There often were groups of women in a community or village who were the, you know, the carers of the dead, and they would be called to come in and wash the body and dress the body and lay the body out in the parlor. So it's interesting that the parlor was where the body was laid out, and then the living room, if you see that word living, the living room is where the living were. So that's an interesting development, because then when funeral homes began to be established, you know, they would often call them funeral parlors, right? So we don't call it that much anymore, but funeral parlors came directly from the fact that the dead were laid out in the parlor of homes before funeral homes and the industry began to be developed. So I would say that the funeral industry, the funeral homes, developed out of really a practice that happened in the Civil War, where especially Northern soldiers who died on Southern battlegrounds, the families of in the North wanted their loved ones to be sent home, their bodies. And so the surgeons and the medical people within the military of the Union soldiers and the Confederate soldiers began embalming bodies in order to preserve them on the trains that sent those bodies home. And that embalming was successful enough that it just became something that first doctors and then people who wanted to become funeral directors were interested in. And then Abraham Lincoln died, and his body was embalmed, and he, you know, traveled across the country mm-hmm. in a train. And that was mm-hmm. a great collective moment, I think, in American history. And it really supported this interest in and belief in embalming as something that was important to do when someone died. Mm-hmm. And so from the very beginning, it became part of the rising development of funeral homes and it becoming businesses. Basically, they became businesses, and it was very much male-dominated, and it became the custom that, you know, you would take the person out of the home and that the all of the things that were done for the care of the body were done somewhere else, not in your home. So it was gradual, and it's still not that true everywhere. You know, people are always caring for their own dead quietly, I would say. But it's become the thing that you do. The mainstream way of caring for our dead is that we give that task, I would say a sacred task, to funeral directors rather than do it ourselves. So mm-hmm. because that business model happened, it also, you know, the bottom line, the charging people a lot of money, mm-hmm. Making it more commercial, making it commodity, it became industrialized. And then, you know, if you're industrialized, then you're trying to keep up with the times. And so you promote not wooden caskets, but metal gasketed ones. And then with this kind of estrangement from caring for our own dead, the collective level of fear and avoidance and denial of death went along right with that, right? Mm-hmm. We can just ask a funeral director to take care of all that, and we don't have to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that collective fear plays into how funeral directors even present their products and things, right? So your families are told often that they should have a metal casket because that will protect their loved one from the elements. And the body won't decompose in a way that will contaminate the groundwater. There's this fear of the dead body that has arisen within the funeral industry practices that still exist. And so the use of chemicals, the use of embalming, I mean, there's really a lot of people who believe that if you don't embalm a body, then it's dangerous. The body is dangerous to other people touching it, and it's actually not mm-hmm. true at all, right? It's not true medically at all. But there's this collective fear of the dead body, essentially, and a lot of the conventional practices have evolved to protect families from having to engage with all of this, and also to protect their own liabilities, right, of families' fear and sensibility of things. It's just created practices that are industrialized and mechanized, mm-hmm. I would say.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that that's hugely true, that people think that they're going to catch something. If somebody dies from a certain condition, a contagious condition, is there any danger at all? Or are there any conditions that someone shouldn't have a natural funeral?
Yes, there are some, yes. I mean, okay. I would say that if a person has died of HIV, that mm-hmm. there are precautions that need to be taken. I mean, as a funeral director, when I got my license, we had to take special course, you know, about HIV.
Mm-hmm.
You would always use, I mean, families can also use gloves as well, you know, this rubber gloves. I mean, you can take precautions, necessary health precautions. But I would really say that there are not very many cases where a body after death is contagious to anyone mm-hmm. handling that person. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that fear is a fear and not a reality.
Okay.
I mean, I would say that, you know, you asked the question, are there times where you should not care for your dead? And I would say, yes. One, not just a contagious disease, but also, you know, if someone has been in a car accident and their body is deeply destroyed, that would not be a time where you would want someone to come home. Although I have helped a family with someone who died in an accident, and we just kept her in a body bag, but she was at home, and all her mm-hmm. classmates were around her.
Mm-hmm.
If someone has had an autopsy, then, you know, again, I would try to assess an individual basis whether that would be a time to care for someone after death. It might not be at all. Okay. Although, again, in the home funeral movement, a lot of us as guides and consultants have helped families care for their own dead even though they've had an autopsy. But these are more unusual circumstances, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what's the experience of a home-based vigil like for those who live in the house?
Well, you mean the people, the family around that person?
Yeah, because I imagine, you know, there's people coming in and out, and it's maybe it's an invasive, and maybe they want some privacy. So, or does that make it easier to deal with that?
Well, I would say that each family is different. And the beauty of a home vigil is that you can create whatever is right for you as a family.
Mm-hmm.
So really, death becomes a part of life again in just your daily life. So
mm-hmm.
if you are a family, you know, that if you're used to having a lot of people come in and out, then it's probably going to be a natural thing that you would have a lot of people coming in and out, even though
mm-hmm.
there's someone who's lying in state in the living room, right? And but that's your way of life, and it's the way of life of the person who's died, and so that would be the natural thing to do. Other people who are more private, who want to have a vigil, they might have a special room set aside for that person to lie in state, and you know, it's considered a quiet space, and you don't talk when you go in there, and you sit quietly and you pray and meditate and read poetry or, you know, do something like that and kind of keep that space separate from the hubbub of the normal daily life.
Mm-hmm.
I like that kind of vigil. That has worked really well when I've helped families do that, because it kind of delineates, you know, this is a sacred space where we're going to honor
yes.
this person, and then you can go in the kitchen and eat and tell stories, and you know, it works well in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also seen vigils where the person is right there in the midst of life and children are running up and touching the hands of the person who's died and running off and playing under the massage table. And I mean, I've seen all of it, and all of it has been incredibly beautiful,
mm-hmm.
mainly because it allows everyone just to be themselves,
mm-hmm.
right? You can just be yourself, and there's something so rich about being able to have all your emotions. I think it's quite healing, again, to be able to cry and just sob and sob and then, you know, laugh in the next moment because somebody has said something funny about that person. And
yeah,
I mean, it's more natural, right, than being in a funeral home where you're in this space where you're just sitting there and you don't feel permission,
right,
to do these things. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And when you ask about the family, it is, in my experience, been so helpful for family members to just be more normal about it, you know.
Yeah.
And their fear of, and there's been a lot of experiences I've had where the family is very reluctant and has a lot of fear about caring for their dead because they've never done it. You know, we've not mm-hmm. done this. You have to, Yeah. And it's really interesting that people will kind of self-select. Some people will be very drawn to helping care for the body, and others will say, no, I just can't do that. Mm-hmm. And again, mm-hmm. everyone's, if they're allowed to be themselves, then they do self-select. And I don't want to, you know, kind of gloss it over. I mean, for some people, it's always hard, and they'll choose not to be part of it, and that's totally okay. I mean, it's very important mm-hmm. for everyone to hear that, you know. But I have had the experience of people being very afraid and not wanting anything to do with it, and then when they have time, an opportunity just to breathe and go in and spend just a little bit of time and then come back out. And often they're the ones who say afterwards that it was the most wonderful and transformative experience they've had.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Ida Mae Gaskins in your book. And for people who don't know, Ida Mae did groundbreaking work in the 70s around home birth. My daughter's a doula and a midwife, and she absolutely worships the ground that Ida Mae walks on, and lots of midwives and doulas do. So am I right in understanding that the death doula work for after death is a bit like doula care for mothers bringing new life into the world, so kind of like a circle of life thing?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I would say that the term midwife, you know, means that you are shepherding someone from across the veil, from for a baby coming into the world, and for someone dying going out of the world, or the physical world anyway. And so, yeah, the whole movement of death midwifery, I mean, in some ways it started by, I mean, I'm 65, you know, so I'm a baby boomer, and in the 70s we were demanding natural birth and being at home, if you could, to have your children, and having midwives be accepted again in society, in the medical profession. And now a lot of us are demanding that we have the same kind of natural care at the end of life and shepherd that person out of life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's often women. I mean, there are lots of wonderful men in this movement too, but it's mostly women. And so there are a lot of parallels with Ida Mae Gaskin and, you know, all the gifts that she brought to the birth midwifery world.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of birth midwives who are now becoming death midwives, and mm-hmm. because it's not that different, really.
No, it's not.
You know, it's
not.
Really not that different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier, in the very beginning, you said that caring for our dead is a legal right. I know that laws vary from state to state, but how can people get more information for how to do this where they are? Is there a website or something?
Yes. I would say go to the National Home Funeral Alliance, that website I spoke about before.
Okay.
Because it has all the resources, and there's even a publication that goes state by state about what's legal in your state and what isn't. And there's a book called Final Rights by Lisa Carlson and Josh Slocum. Yeah. And that actually goes state by state as well. And it's such a wonderful resource, yeah. And I would highly recommend, if you are considering any of these alternatives, including green burial, because sadly green burial is not possible in a lot of places, because the cemeteries have been, you know, taken over by funeral homes that want to have conventional burial. And so there's actually a shortage of natural burial sites, although that's changing as the interest in green burial grows. But all of that information, I would go to the National Home Funeral Alliance, which is homefuneralalliance.org. Yes.
Okay.
And it's also
and
in my book.
Right.
Yeah.
And how would you suggest someone handle it if they want a home death and natural burial, but their survivors are against it?
Well, I tell a story in my book of my own family who I have lived out in the West for a long time, but my family's from Alabama, and I went home and really wanted to care for my mother in this way. and they were resistant. And the story is about what happened. Quite an amazing thing happened around that. So I recommend people who love stories to read it. But I had from the beginning, the experience of wanting to do this myself in a family that was very reluctant. And so I would say, one, that it's really important to talk about it before a death happens.
Yeah.
And to have family, study it and talk about it. I mean, there's a wonderful film called A Family Undertaking that PBS put out several years ago. There's a lot of videos now where you can actually see, you know, what it means to care for someone at home, and just pictures paint 1,000 words. So, just being able to experience it a little bit, and so that you're not devoid of knowing what it really means, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very true that if you've experienced caring for someone at home, it's almost like an initiation, right? Where you, once you've experienced it, you're much more comfortable and much more likely to say, this is fine, we can do this, right? But you have to start somewhere. And so starting with reading a book like mine, Reimagining Death, reading stories from the Home Funeral Alliance website of families who've done it, watching these films and documentaries, people can just get more comfortable with it, and also be able to say, well, you know, I just really don't want to do that, and self-select out.
Because
in my family, I have three sisters, and one of my sisters and I were the ones who cared for my mother and my father after death, and my other two sisters cared for them very deeply beforehand. It's possible. If every member doesn't want to do it, it's still possible. And it's also possible that it's not the right thing, and that one should say, well, this isn't going to work for our family. I mean, part of my consultation work now is to go and work with families and, you know, paint these pictures and help them understand what they might be saying yes to, and training them in what they need to know. And then at the end of it, saying, you just don't have enough people on your team to make this happen in a way that won't be stressful. Yeah. And so my recommendation would be that you don't do it. So again, it's individual and unique to each person's circumstance.
Well, that's a lot of information that I'm sure most people just don't even think about. So thanks so much, Lucinda, for sharing it with us. And can you tell us again the name of the book?
Yes, my book is called Reimagining Death, Stories and Practical Wisdom for Home Funerals and Green Burials. And it's published by North Atlantic Books. And you can find it in most bookstores, happily, and in the libraries, and on Amazon and at Penguin Random House website. And actually, you can find it on my website as well, www.lucindaherring.com. And you can buy it through PayPal, and I can mail it to you.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. I wish we had more time. There were so many other things I wanted to ask you. But thank you so much for sharing with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you, Laura. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks.
And I thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. Your questions, comments, likes, shares, and donations keep the love chain going, so keep reaching out. This helps us to know what's resonating with you and helps us to come up with content for future shows. If you want to reach out and email me, you can do that at laura@pansociety.net. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. That's our show this week. If you want to join us live and you're in the Richmond, Virginia area, check out our Moon Circles and Holy Day celebrations. We also host quarterly retreats that focus on one element. These are designed to help you sink down into the energy of that element and learn how to live with them and flow with your life. You are most welcome to join us for the next one, and we will focus on the energy of fire in the summer. You can see our website for details. Thank you all for joining us for this edition of Pan Society Radio. My thanks to the elements and ancestors. I'm so grateful for all of you being here and tuning in, and see you next week.